Part two. I think we should, we can discuss over coffee and the next office hours if you want to. We can talk about the crisis theory and its relation to this. Let's get to complexity, class structure. So, like many of the topics of this semester, every topic illustrates both some meta-theoretical points, some abstract general ideas that apply to almost any topic you might want to study, as well as concrete points about the specific topic at hand. The problem of complexity of class structures, I think, is a really nice one because it really is a good context for thinking about different levels of abstraction at which you talk about the same problem, but at different levels of abstraction. And so here's the basic context for this issue. In Marx's theory, building a concept of class around the concept of exploitation, so exploitation is the kind of gut core connected to this closely related concept of oppression, of non-exploitative oppression. So those two together, really, that's the gut core of the concept. You're building a concept of class around it. That naturally leads you to this binary, polarized idea of class. There's exploiters and there's exploited. And when you get your first approximation picture of capitalism, you have capitalists and workers. Two classes. The Schmoo story has two classes. There's the capitalist PU, there's his manager, who is really his henchman. You know, they're really a block. They form a solid block. Their interests are not divided. So even though one is the capitalist and other is the CEO, it's clear from the story that they are a single category. And then there's everybody else, dog patch residents. Very simple model, and it reveals this underlying logic of exploitation. It just seems that the world is much more complicated than that. And if we as sociologists want to explain various phenomena, the kind of class concept we want just seems to need extra complexity. Now, there's really two different kinds of moves you can make. So this is the meta-theoretical point. Here's one strategy you could adopt. You could say, no, let's keep the simple concept because that's the concept that directly maps this core idea best. The world consists of capitalists and workers. And then there's some residual categories. So there's self-employed people. Well, even in classical Marxism, there were residual categories. Self-employed people would be called petty bourgeois, petty bourgeoisie. Petty means just little, not petty like small-minded. It's petite bourgeoisie in French. Let's just keep the simple category. And then if we want to explain things like why do people vote the way they do, we just acknowledge, well, class doesn't explain it because all of the variance in the outcome is among the workers. And so we need a bunch of other concepts. It's not that class is going to explain why people vote the way they do, other things. So we'll introduce a whole series of additional concepts. Maybe they could be status concepts. We could borrow from Weber. We can have a status inequalities explain the variation in voting within the class of workers. But everybody from kind of middle management, maybe even upper middle management, to the lowliest janitor in a corporation, they're all in one class. So we keep the concept of class simple, binary, and we add complexity to the analysis by introducing non-class concepts. That's one strategy you could adopt. Another strategy is to say, if we want to explain concrete outcomes, we need to lower the level of abstraction of our concept of class itself. We need to think through ways in which the concept of class itself can be differentiated at a lower level of abstraction. And then the question is, well, How do you do that? What does it mean? How do you move from a high to a low level of abstraction in the analysis of class structure? What would be the strategies? How can we do this in a way that isn't arbitrary? You just willy-nilly add complexities. How can you do it systematically? Well, that's the strategy I took. I adopted, I said, I want to make this concept more concrete by adding systematic complexities interior to the concept of class. And I did so through a couple of different strategies. They were all designed to figure out how to deal with the following sorts of cases. So these were all cases which at a pre-theoretical level didn't seem to fit the binary concept well. Managers, supervisors, professors, engineers, high-paid athletes. They just all didn't fit comfortably into the simple binary bourgeoisie and proletariat model. How to deal with all these categories? They were all categories which in a very loose sense would be called middle class. You know, some of them are upper middle class, but we don't have to worry about that. Just in ordinary language, what to do with the middle class? I wrote a paper once called What's Middle About the Middle Class? You know, what's in a relational concept, how do you cope with these categories? Well, this is what led me in the 1970s, when I first began doing this stuff, led me on this journey through the problem of concept formation. I think I assigned the biography of a concept chapter, which is sort of the autobiography of my work on the concept as well, to kind of show you how I navigated this. In the course of doing that, I discovered that there were other kinds of complexities besides the ones that I initially thought of. So my initial effort was just to add complexity to the structural account of class. But then I realized that there's a whole other kind of complexity that I kind of stumbled upon, which is that there's complexity in the ways people's lives are embedded in class structures, which actually change the meaning of the location. So this gets kind of tricky. The simplest case of this additional form of complexity is people form families. And when you have both, when you have two earner families, you can have people who are in their jobs in different locations in the class structure. But they live in families together, where they share a common consumption. So to take a kind of clear case, what happens if you have a school teacher who's an ordinary elementary school teacher, part of the union, married to a wealthy capitalist? And there are plenty of people like that. You know, these aren't, I mean, of course, it's not a high percentage of the population, but a pretty high percentage of wealthy capitalist owners in the unambiguous sense of them being capitalists. You know, they own the means of production, they run businesses, they have lots of employees. In the 21st century, a large percentage of them, when they're men, are married to women who actually work in the labor force. They're not stay-at-home debutante elites, they work. And a fair number of them are things like school teachers. So what's the class position of this person? Well, that's a kind of complexity, right? It's a sort of complexity. I had a graduate student 30 years ago by now, who did a really interesting dissertation about Mexico, about two regions of Mexico, which had roughly the same proportion of the labor force being agricultural laborers and being smallholder peasants, roughly the same proportions. But in one region, they were all married to each other. They were all in the same families. So a typical household would be a small-holding household in which somebody in the household would also work as a laborer. And in another region, these were separate households. That is, you'd have laboring households and smallholder households. Now those, in terms of individuals, look like the same class structure. But in terms of complexity, they're very different. Very different kind of class structure. And he was interested in whether unions would be more likely in the case where you had proletarianized households or where you had smallholder households with proletarian members. And you can see how it could go either way. Smallholder households with proletarian members, the smallholder household is a kind of insurance function for the worker. The worker has a supply of food, so to speak, from the family, less dependent fully, exclusively on the job, and therefore a greater capacity to resist. On the other hand, solidarities might be stronger if everybody's proletarianized in a region. Who is proletarianized? Their whole households are. Well, that's the kind of question you can ask if you think systematically about adding complexity. So family structure is another form of complexity, and that, as we'll see, turns out to be a really interesting kind of complexity with respect to the class and gender connection. Okay, so I had to think about how am I going to do these kinds of complexity. There are these two. I've already jumped down to, no, I'm still on number one. Two different kinds of complexities. Complexities linked to the character of locations and complexities linked to how lives are linked to those complexities. There are many ways of doing this. I've tried to balance keeping things simple. You know, I think there's a risk of over-complexification. That's a bigger risk in social theory than oversimplification. So I think it's always better to slightly overshoot and in your efforts to get just the right level of simplification, it's better to overshoot a little bit on the side of oversimplification than to undershoot on the side of over-complexification. I've grappled with this for a long time. The effort is to do what I would call create coherent complexity. And I think in the end, I've only partially succeeded. You know, I've tried a variety of ways. In the end, you kind of have to settle for the best you can do and have a set of concepts which have a fairly high degree of coherent complexity, but it's coherent complexity with some loose ends where not everything fits so neatly. Okay, let me jump down to number four here. To the two kinds of proposals, the two ways in which I approach this. The first way of approaching it. This emerged in my initial work for my dissertation, which I did, the initial kind of theoretical and empirical work was done jointly with my friend Luca Perrone, who is, I think I told you the story, he was my graduate chum. In our efforts to use an existing set of data and to squeeze it into Marxian class categories, we decided that there were really two dimensions to class relations. One was a domination dimension, and one was an ownership. So we had a simple 2x2 table. Do you own the means of production? Yes or no. Do you dominate others in production? Yes or no. Four categories. Capitalists both own the means of production and dominate others. Workers neither own the means of production nor are they dominant. They are subordinates within production. The petty bourgeoisie own the means of production but don't dominate anybody. They're self-employed. And then there was this other category. Dominate but don't own the means of production. Those were managers. So the initial work had these four categories. Capitalists, self-employed, workers, and managers. Managers both owned the, were excluded from one aspect of class relations. They were non-owners, they were employees, but they were the dominators within the relations of domination. I initially called those positions ambiguous class relations positions. Did I tell you this part of the story? I don't think I've told you this part of the story. Initially, my initial label for this was that they were in ambiguous class relations. And I was, as I think I told you, part of this network of graduate students that held regular research workshops and discussions in the Bay Area. And I was presenting at the Stanford Political Economy seminar, these ideas. And one of the people in the audience was a graduate student in anthropology at Stanford named Bridget O'Loughlin. And in the discussion of my paper, she said, you know, I don't think those positions are exactly ambiguous. I think they're contradictory. And I gave her credit for this in a, you know, in a footnote. And the moment she said that, bang, you know, that was a kind of epiphany moment. I knew, you nailed it, that's right. And that opened up a much richer space for thinking about what's going on here. And that introduced this idea that actually locations are multidimensional. What we think of as the simple binary polarized relation, it's actually a package of relations. There's relational complexity, and the package can get disentangled, so that some people can be simultaneously in more than one class. Managers occupy a contradictory location within class relations because they're simultaneously capitalists and workers. They're workers insofar as they are subordinated within the relations of ownership, the ownership relations, the property relations. They're excluded from the means of production. They're capitalists insofar as they occupy the position of dominator within the relations of production. They're simultaneously in two classes which are contradictory. And in that initial move, I then also thought, well, is there a contradictory location that combines capitalist and petty bourgeois? And I thought, well, small employers. They work alongside their workers. They do the same work as we were talking about hair salons this morning in the office hours. They work alongside. They maybe exploit their workers a little bit, but they don't actually live much better than their workers. Small employers are kind of simultaneously petty bourgeois and capitalists. And then I thought, well, is there a contradictory location that combines petty bourgeois aspects and worker aspects? And I thought, what about professors? I mean, we are workers, we're employed, you know, we sell our labor on the labor market, but we're like petty bourgeoisie because we control our own activity. The petty bourgeoisie are autonomous, self-directed worker producers. Well, academics are pretty much like that. We have a lot of autonomy. And I thought, aha, let's call those positions semi-autonomous employees. You know, I hedged a little by saying semi. I probably should have said autonomous employees. I would have captured the point. And then I thought, well, there's a lot of such autonomous employees, not just professors. In a lot of workplaces, there are people with very high levels of skills, very difficult to monitor. They're given a lot of self-direction over their own work. Not out of benevolence, but because then the technical conditions of production make that the best way of organizing work. But because of that, they really are in a different position. They're not as subordinated in production. So they're not as dominated, even though they're not themselves dominators. So quickly you see how the contradictory class locations things began to clarify and allow to deepen a more differentiated space. And that then stabilized as my first solution. Then I hit John Romer's work. So that initial work was done in the late 70s. It's consolidated in my dissertation and in the book that came out of it. And I was then launched my big cross-national class structure project and was involved with a lot of cool empirical work and lots of interesting travel to European countries to collaborate with people. And then I became engaged in the No Bullshit Marxism group, or AKA Analytical Marxism group. And John Romer's complex and very provocative at the time work on exploitation, where Romer basically argued, at least my tweaking of his perspective, but you know, this came very closely out of what he said. He said, there's actually multiple forms of exploitation in capitalism. It's not just capitalist exploitation. There's also what he called skill exploitation and what he called status exploitation. These are all economic mechanisms, though. So he didn't mean status in the Weberian sense. It wasn't race and gender exploitation. It was exploitation by virtue of your status in an organization. And I grappled with his work. I provided some critiques. I changed my views. We engaged in this very creative, I think, for me, I mean, intellectually creative, provocative, and helped me create new ideas around it. In which then I said, it's a different way of thinking about contradictory locations. Maybe some people are in contradictory locations with respect to the mechanisms of exploitation. So it's not that they're in two classes at the same time, it's that they relate to the process of exploitation in contradictory ways. Some people can be capitalistically exploited, but still be skill exploiters. Some people could be capitalistically exploited, but organizational exploiters. So this way of thinking about it said, well, what's distinctive about managers is that they are organizational exploiters by virtue of their position in the authority structure. They are able to extract surplus through those positions. And what's distinctive about professors in this respect, and engineers and doctors, is not their autonomy within the labor process, although that's also a feature, but rather that because of their monopoly over skills, particularly credentialed skills, they're able to extract rent in the labor market. Rent in the labor market, that's the economist way of saying it. That is, they can extract wages above the cost of producing their skills by virtue of their ability to exclude other people from getting those skills. So their credentials create a rent. And managers get a different kind of rent by virtue of their control over the apparatus of domination. They get what I call a loyalty rent from their control over the organization. And skilled workers get a skill rent. And rents, in this kind of technical economic term, was a way of talking about how people were able to grab part of the social surplus so that their wages included an ordinary wage, which is the cost of producing and reproducing their labor power, plus a piece of the social surplus, which they are able to grab because of their exclusionary power. That is, their control over either an organizational position, exclude other people from management, or their control over credentials. And this led to this multiple exploitations view of complexity. Some people are exploiters on some dimensions, exploited on others. It may be very hard to know whether they are net exploiters. Very high income wage earners are likely to be net exploiters. That is, they are appropriating more surplus than they are themselves contributing. The problem with this multiple exploitations view is that the people who are in these special positions are also performing labor, which is contributing to the surplus. So they're producing surplus, but are able to retain part of it. Now, does this mean that they are net exploiters, or they're just less exploited? Does the high wage, the high wage of full professors at elite universities, does this mean that they are a net recipient of the social surplus, above and beyond whatever they've contributed? Or they are just less exploited? Well, those are interesting questions, probably not answerable. You know, there's probably no clear strategy. I certainly didn't have a way of measuring these things. But that was my second solution. So I had these two different strategies. Strategy one, add complexity to the structural account by saying people can occupy more than one class at the same time. The absolutely simplest version of that are people who have two jobs. So it's not so uncommon. I think the following particular combination: somebody works for a construction company during the week, and they're a self-employed home repair person on the weekends. So they're petty bourgeois on the weekends, and they're working class during the week. That combination, somebody holds two jobs, one petty bourgeois, self-employed, often self-employed in the gray economy because they're paid in cash and they don't pay taxes on it. So their self-employment turns out to be pretty lucrative because of, you know, the under-the-table quality of it. The only reason we have a carpenter in our midst, so I was naturally drawn, I know. I'm sure you do. I was drawn to our laboring colleague here, you know, who knows how to swing a hammer. when that thought popped into my head to use that as my example. I'm sure you've known many people in your day who moonlight as self-employed fix-it people and make a fair amount of extra cash that way. And their employment is anchored in these two worlds. And that's a contradictory class location. They are located in two classes at the same time. But there's also the managers, which are contradictory class locations within one job. You know, so this added a lot of interesting complexity through the two class contradictory location. And the multiple exploitations was also, I thought, an interesting effort. Both of those solutions had problems. So the way I approached trying to do this complexification strategy was always to do my best, the best I could in making a case for this being a useful way of adding complexity to the more abstract concept. And then all the ways in which I wasn't sure I was right, I would make clear. I would lay out, here are the problems. Rather than what uncharitably I would call the French strategy, which is to pretend you have everything, and to try to obscure all the gaps in your own reasoning. So now I've said this to you before. I think it should be an aspiration for you when you write to make yourself vulnerable to the kinds of criticisms which will improve your work. That's really nerve-wracking. You know, and it's especially, you know, it's easier for me to say this now, of course. It's hard, but it's the perspective you should have about what you're doing. You're in a dialogue with other people. You're writing for the world. You're not writing because you are a guru or a prophet that has everything sewn up because of divine inspiration, right? You're writing because you're entering into a dialogue through which knowledge is advanced. Okay, my little sermon for the moment. I laid out these problems, and they always niggled at me, you know, and then people would pick up on them. Some people would there were occasional critiques of my work which were kind of mocking, that I can't make up my mind, there's these two rights, which is the right, you know, that kind of getting right, there's a paper under that title. And people would kind of make fun of the fact that I keep changing my position, as if that's a bad thing, you know, as if that just shows I'm flip-flopping. It's a kind of absurd view of, I think, intellectual work. The fact is, I don't think I've got it all tied up, and the position which I've kind of settled down to is a kind of uncomfortable combination of these two initial strategies. I think the original strategy for thinking about managers is better than the second strategy. I think managers basically are in positions of domination within a complex set of relations, that they really combine capitalist and working class aspects, and that we can then define different kinds of managers in a managerial hierarchy in terms of whether the working class weight or the capitalist weight of their contradictory relational characteristics dominates. So foremen and supervisors are much more like workers than our top managers, even though they are all in contradictory locations, which was reflected in the contradictory pressures under which they live their work lives. So I think the domination idea works better for understanding managers than saying that what's distinctive about them is a distinctive form of exploitation. They may also have a distinctive form of exploitation by virtue of their authority, but that's not really what defines the lived reality of their interests and their structural position. It's their location within the domination structure of production. On the other hand, highly skilled employees, it is really the case that their control over credentials gives them privileged access to resources in restricted labor markets, which give them advantage. And that does seem better captured by the notion that there's a particular mechanism of surplus acquisition, if not extraction, that comes by virtue of having highly credentialed skills, or in special cases, highly talented labor power. So just to draw this distinction, I don't know if I've used this rhetoric before, the distinction between skill and talent. Talent, you should think, I think talent should be thought of as the means of production of skill when combined with other means of production, like basketball courts. So a talented basketball player is somebody who developed incredible skills by using that talent to produce the skills when combined with coaches and instruction and time on the basketball court. Some talent is such that some skills can only be acquired if you're talented. Right, so no matter how hard I would work at basketball, there's no way I could be, let's see, who's a short basketball, Bugsy Mose, right? He's probably a little shorter than me, but still, yeah. Right? So I'm a pretty competent violinist. I could have practiced 12 hours a day my entire life and I wouldn't be a Saul Perlman. There's just no way I could possibly do that. So I could become a competent fiddler for parties and to play at the last row of college orchestras, but not, you know, to be a concert violin. Okay, but talent is the capacity to produce skills. It's extraordinarily rare that the skills aren't cultivated. You know, there are these occasional phenomena where somebody has raw talent which is cashed out as skill without much cultivation. But mostly people who have high skills work their butts off to turn their talent into skill. But it's scarce. So particularly at this high end of skills, there's a natural scarcity. So you then get rents. If there's a market for it, you get rents for it because it's like Rembrandt. You know, it's not reproducible labor power. It's in permanent short supply because the underlying distribution of talent is in short supply, just because it has more or less a normal distribution. And if you're way out on the talent end enables you to produce skills that nobody else can have. I think it's better to think of that as generating a privileged position with respect to the process of exploitation, where you can appropriate part of the social surplus by virtue of your skills. So I've combined the two categories, the two approaches. My language is a little bit looser now. I'm a little bit more relaxed about this. You know, I think you just have to muddle through with this kind of way. I still think that the idea of contradictory locations is a nice way of summarizing this issue, that the middle class, through a variety of different means, occupy contradictory positions within a class structure. Contradictory with respect to the relations of domination, and contradictory with respect to the process of exploitation. That's the first cluster of complexities. Let me just very quickly talk about these other complexities. This is under Roman numeral 3. These are the kinds of additional complexities that in many concrete research projects, this is actually where the action is. It depends upon what problems you're studying. But this is often where the real action. These other complexities all come from the fact that what we really are ultimately interested in is how people live their lives, and how the way you live your lives in a world of classes, class relations, affects your interests and your experiences. So remember from an earlier lecture I said that class is a way of talking about the causal processes in the world that shape the material interests of people and shape their lived experiences. So an example of a lived experience is being bossed around in a job where you have no control over what you're doing. That's something that happens to you. An example of your interests is what do you have to do in order to improve the material standard of living? So what you have to do to improve your material standard of living is different if you're a capitalist than if you're a worker. What you have to do to get what you get, that's the code word for the way of thinking about what it means to talk about interests. What happens to you when you do what you have to do to get what you get is about your life experience. Okay, well, here's a list of other complexities that come when you really start worrying about these things. Mediated locations, I've already mentioned. That's the fact that you live in families. And some of your class interests, in particular, come from your connection to other people who are located in the class structure. This is obvious for children. Right, so in casual conversation, people don't have much trouble saying this is a working class kid, right? Well, what does that mean? It doesn't mean that this child works in a sweatshop. It might mean that, but it's not usually what we mean. It means that it's a child in a working class family, by which we mean it's a child in a family in which the adults generating the material conditions of life in the family are in the working class, in working class jobs. That's a mediated location. The child's class location is derived from their relationship to their parents. Spouses have mediated locations when they're both in the labor force because they have a direct class location from their own jobs and a mediated location via the jobs of their parents. And it turns out that's a pretty interesting problem in the world today because it's often the case once you have this more complicated structural map where you have contradictory locations within class relations, then it turns out a lot of households are cross-class households. It's not rare. And it's an important form of complexity. It's one of the reasons why, even though wages have been stagnant over the last 40 years, more or less, household income has not been. Household income has risen. And furthermore, even though individual wages are stagnant, if you look at a person's wage profile over time in their own lives, they're not stagnant. Most people who are 50 today earn more than they did when they were 30. Their levels of household income and their levels of personal earnings are higher when they're 50 than when they're 30, even though the average income of a 50-year-old isn't higher than it was 30 years ago, and the average income of a 30-year-old isn't higher than it was 30 years ago. But the age profile of wages continues to be positive. That's a really important point. You know, this is an intervention into the general notion about social stability in the world today. It's often pointed out, my God, look at this. We're in an era of fantastically increasing inequality with incomes at the top going through the roof and incomes at the middle being stagnant. That doesn't mean that the income of people at the middle is stagnant over their own lives because they earn more at 50 than they did at 30. There still is a positive age gradient to earnings. And that has a lot to do, I think, with the sense that things aren't quite as bad as you might otherwise think. Because the individual life experience of navigating this economy occurs over time, biographically. It's not comparative statics, you know, in the way that people don't compare themselves so much to people who were 50, 30 years ago. A little bit of that. But they do compare themselves to what they were like 30 years ago. Okay, that's mediated. I've mentioned the career structure. Career structure in terms of wage trajectories is important, but also in terms of mobility. You know, so when we talk about class mobility, there's really two quite separate issues. One is the relationship between your class origins and your current class. How do you compare to your parents? Usually in sociological research, this is to your fathers. That's just the way they do it. Because of the historically father-to-son mobility was more at the core of the class mobility problem in a world where women didn't work as consistently in the labor market as they do now. But there's intergenerational mobility, but there's also intra-generational mobility. Now, intragenerational mobility turns out to be more significant than you might initially imagine. Not because a very large number of people have upward mobility, but because it's sufficiently common that it's part of the probabilistic view of life for people at the beginning of their career. People at the beginning of their work lives do not all believe that they are going to end up in the same position where they start. We're in a world where there's a reasonable possibility that through hook or by crook or by chance or one thing or another, things might improve or get worse. Right? So there's a certain amount of mobility. It used to be that there was something called career ladders. These are much less common now. In academic life, it's one of the enclaves where there still are career ladders. Although even in academic life, it's more restricted than it used to be because of the increasing use of nomadic adjuncts to fill faculty positions. But still, this is a domain within which there are career structures. A career ladder means you can begin as a worker and end as a manager in a somewhat predictable way. And in some places in the world, Japan in particular, it was the case that all managers had to begin as workers. It's a requirement of the job. You know, you're educated, you're trained to be a manager, but you have to start on the shop floor because they wanted all their managers to know what it's like to work on the shop floor. Okay, career structures is another complexity. Here's a complexity that's a big deal complexity. Currently, about 40%, you know, it's the right order of magnitude, it may not be the right number, of Americans own stock. And not just because they have pensions that are invested in stock. So every California state worker has a California pension, and I have a Wisconsin pension. The pension fund of Wisconsin, which my salary has been partially contributing to, is invested in stocks. But I don't have any control over the stocks. I can't sell them. I can't. If I die, my children don't inherit them. So I don't own those stocks, even though the income from those stocks will fund my pension when I retire. Or since I don't plan to retire, it'll just stay in the pension fund. When I become demented and I'm forced to retire, then I'll live off of it. But 40% of the population owns some stock independently of that. They actually own stock, which they can sell and which their children can inherit. Now, mostly it's trivial. It's a tiny amount of stock. You know, they don't have a stock that the dividends could provide them with an income stream of any sort. But 40% of the population owns stock. It used to be about 10%. What we have is this very weird situation where a higher diffusion of stock ownership in the population along with a higher concentration at the top. Right? That's why you see ads if you watch the football game, the Super Bowl, you'll see ads for stockbrokers. I mean, it's ridiculous to have ads for stockbrokers on a mass market television program unless you expect that there's an awful lot of people out there who are going to own a little bit of stock. Well, how should we think about that? The way I like to think about it is this is a property of our class structure, that there's enough of the population, because we're such a rich and high productivity society, there's a significant enough portion of the population that they have discretionary income, where they can make a choice between, am I going to spend it now and have an even bigger television and a nicer car, or am I going to take part of my discretionary income and capitalize it by investing it in a 401k or in some other stock fund? And 40% of the population does that. Again, mostly not very much, but it represents a change in the class structure. And those people, I think, their class positions are altered, mostly just a little bit, but it means that they look at the stock reports differently. Every morning on NPR, they tell you what the damn Dow Jones is doing. Who cares? I mean, in a previous world, that wasn't reported on every news program because the vast majority of people had nothing to do with it. Now, a significant chunk of the population does. That's a change in the class structure. Yeah?
You need to know how much is due to credit, increased credit, though. You know what I mean?
Well, mostly I don't think people borrow and then put the money in a 401k.
But could they have the indirect due to refinancing and other aspects of the credit market too?
Sure.
Right,
so there's lots of mechanisms by which this occurred. When in the period when housing prices were blowing up, people could get a second mortgage, get cash from that, and then they could put some of that cash into a pension fund. Into a 401k or something. That would be something that some people would do. There's all sorts of ways that people got access to discretionary income, that is income above what they need to maintain the standard of living which they want, and invest it. But by doing so, they change their class position by making it more complicated, more complex. And capitalizing on high income is a crucial thing. And indeed, I think it's one of the pivotal issues around the change in the income distribution, is the increasing percentage of the population which become oriented towards capitalistic ways of thinking about their position in the society. So using the adjective capitalistic. So they're not capitalists in the kind of hardcore sense. They don't live off of their capital. But they accumulate enough capital that it's a significant part of their understanding of their interests. And I have colleagues, who were very clever investors and who invested in combinations of real estate at the right time and in stocks, who actually have become, in terms of their assets, very wealthy, like several million dollars worth of assets by the time they retire. So if academic salaries are such that if you live modestly, you have a lot of discretionary income. The income is above what you need to live a respectable academic life, because academic ways of life, at least historically, have had negative status from conspicuous consumption. So I once had a colleague who had a really fancy, expensive sports car. And he would drive it around as if he was a business executive, and people thought it was ridiculous. He didn't get any status points from that. He got ridicule from that. Right. I think that's a change in both the class position of those people. It means that not all professors are in the same class position, because they have access to resources which they can capitalize and turn into capitalist assets. All right, well, we're out of time. Those are key aspects of complexity. And next week, I guess it's class and gender and class and race. Okay.